Thank you, Suthan. Thank you very much for the invitation. I agree that I know my lab has a great need for mathematicians and people who can contribute in terms of understanding the mechanics of the heart valve. That's what we work on, especially at the cellular level. What I'm going to present today is largely or almost exclusively experimental and largely biology-based. And I'm hoping that what you'll get out of this is that it does motivate the need for improved analytical methods to really understand the mechanical environment of the valve in order to understand this biological function. And that's really what our work is. It's trying to link the biology to the mechanics. And to do so, obviously, we need to understand the mechanics. And I don't think we do that as well as we could right now. And to see this is a really good opportunity. So what I'm going to talk about today is the aortic valve. So here's the heart, and the aortic valve is a three-leaflet valve that sits between the left ventricle that pumps the blood to the rest of the body and the aorta, the main blood vessel, thank you, that takes the blood to the rest of the body. And it functions just as a check valve. It prevents the flow of blood. It ensures unidirectional flow of the blood and prevents blood from flowing back into the heart during the relaxation phase diastole. This valve is remarkable from an engineering perspective. It's made up of three leaflets. They look like this when they're cut out and laid open. And these leaflets are very thin, about 500 microns in thickness. They have a really well-organized collagen structure that provides them with the strength in the circumferential direction. And if you look at them in cross-section, they actually have a three-layer morphology or structure in which the layer closest to the aorta, the fibrosa, is filled with collagen fibers. The layer closest to the ventricle is filled with elastin and collagen, and then the intervening layer is proteoglycans. And so this trilayer structure provides the valve with its functional properties, its mechanical properties, and is thought to be necessary in order to ensure proper open and closure of these leaflets. This is all done passively in response to pressure gradients. There's no muscle contraction. There's nothing like that opening and closing these valves. They just simply open and close due to the pressure gradients. This leaflet is not only structural, but it also has cellular components. And so there are endothelial cells that line the surface of the leaflet, and then interstitial cells, valve interstitial cells that I'll talk a lot about today called VICs, these are cells that populate the inside of the leaflet matrix. And so these cells are believed to be very important, and we know are important for maintenance of valve structure, maintenance of valve health, and remodeling of the valve. So in many of us, the valve will continue to function normally, and it will look like this. You can see the leaflets are very thin, pliable, the valve opens fully, there's no obstruction to flow. This is the case of a severely stenotic or calcified aortic valve, and this is the disease we study. And right away, you can appreciate that the leaflets are thickened compared to here. They're no longer transparent. There's discoloration, there's lumpiness, there's been changes in the matrix of the valve. And you can see it doesn't open fully. It's stiffened and therefore is unable to open fully and more resistive to the flow. This obviously then creates a greater load on the heart. The heart has to pump harder to get the blood out, basically. And this is associated with lots of cardiovascular events, or adverse cardiovascular events. So this is what we're interested in understanding is what happens when we go from a normal valve to a disease valve and what might be regulating or mediating this process. And so the disease is called calcific aortic valve disease, and it really covers a spectrum of disease from the initial stages when the cells are just changing their biology to early disease called sclerosis, where the leaflets are thickened but not necessarily obstructing flow, to clinically what's known as calcific aortic valve disease, where the valve is actually now stenotic. It does impede flow out of the left ventricle. And this is when the disease is intervened with at this stage, because this is the most detectable stage, and there isn't any medical treatment. Even if it's detected at this stage, there's nothing really that can be done at this point except to allow it to progress to this stage, and then it's cut out and replaced surgically. So this is a common disease, and about 25% of adults over the age of 65 will have this early sign of the disease. And if you have this, it's associated with a 50% increase in adverse cardiovascular events, so other cardiovascular problems. Stenosis, the advanced form of the disease, occurs in about 2-3% of adults over the 65 years of age. And again, there's no treatment for this except to cut it out and replace it surgically. And so because of this high prevalence and increasing prevalence as the population ages and lives longer, And because there really is no treatment for it, some have called this disease the next cardiac epidemic. And so we're interested again in what causes this. Now, traditionally it was thought that this was just wear and tear on the valve. It's a material, it's opening and closing with every heartbeat. It's, you know, reasonable to assume that it's just going to break down. We now recognize that that's not the case. In fact, there's a lot of biology going on there and a lot of active cell-mediated processes that are causing the disease to go from normal to diseased, and several risk factors that are associated with the disease. And certainly not everybody gets valve disease. In fact, the majority of us won't. And certainly people who have these risk factors are more prone to disease. So it suggests it's not inevitable that, in fact, there are certain, again, risk factors and biological processes that's involved. And so what's happening on the cellular level, and this is, I want to give this background because this is where we focus on how the cells respond to the mechanics. These cells within the valve of a healthy valve are relatively quiescent. So these are these valve interstitial cells, these dots that populate the valve matrix. And as the disease progresses to early disease, there is the appearance of myofibroblasts. These are contractile cells that are fibrotic. They make a lot of matrix, and they will thicken this valve through the production of matrix. And they express a protein called smooth muscle alpha actin that I'll refer to later. There's also appearance in mid-stage disease of osteoblasts, bone-forming cells. You can actually get bone formation within the heart valve. This is apparent through the production of osteocalcin, a matrix protein, as well as the expression of cells that express RUNX2, a transcription factor for bone formation. So I mentioned these because I'm going to refer to them later as markers of bone and myofibroblasts. And you know, the origin of these cells, so these are cells appear in disease, and it's not really clear, it wasn't really clear where these cells come from. There is some evidence that maybe these quiescent VICs can turn into myofibroblasts, but really where these bone-forming cells come from was unknown. You know, why do we get bone, and how do we get bone in heart valves? And work from our lab by Jan Chen, recent PhD grad, showed that these heart valve cells are very similar to the stem cells that you would find in bone marrow or other sources, in that you could take a valve cell, in this case from a pig, and by treating it in culture, you could make it become bone, you could make it become fat, you could make it become a myofibroblast, a muscle-like cell, and you could make it become a cartilage cell. So the heart valve contains these cells that have all this potential, very much like stem cells from other sources. And you know, the question is, in disease, what causes these cells to become dysregulated? What causes this valve interstitial cell to become a bone cell to contribute to the calcification, or to become a myofibroblast to contribute to the fibrosis? And so the thought now is that these VICs are actually rich in a progenitor or stem cell population, and it's these cells that are become dysfunctional and go on to form these cell types associated with disease. Now, ultimately, these cells will go on to cause fibrosis or thickening and excessive matrix deposition, as well as calcification through bone formation. And in stenosis, there's also evidence of calcification occurring through other processes. But what's really interesting and what caught our attention from a mechanical engineering perspective is that all of these changes occur predominantly in the fibrosal layer, in this top layer. And so it's spatially predictable disease. And that's important, we think, because if we understand what is it about this layer that makes the disease progress, perhaps that'll provide some clues as to the mechanisms involved. And we've hypothesized that perhaps this microenvironment in this fibrosal layer is somehow permissive to this pathological differentiation, the transition of a quiescent VIC or a valve stem cell to these disease phenotypes. And perhaps it's something unique about this environment, this layer, that's different than the other layers. So that's driven our research, and that's been our approach to trying to understand valve disease, and we're kind of unique in that perspective. So there's lots of things you could imagine that would be different in the fibrosa than in either of the other layers, and you know, we've reviewed several of them here. What I want to focus on today are the mechanical environment, and because the mechanical environment in the fibrosa is very different than it is anywhere else in the valve. And this is reflected in at least two ways. One is that the hemodynamics, the blood flow patterns on the fibrosa side, is very different than they are on the ventricular side. And so our hypothesis is that the hemodynamics influences the endothelial cells that line the valve and experience the shear stress. And then these cells then make soluble factors called paracrine signals that then can talk to these or influence the cells within the valve matrix. and control this differentiation to myofibroblasts or osteoblasts. So one idea is that the hemodynamics is somehow different up here than it is here, and that's influencing the biology. The other idea is that the cells within the valve matrix itself may be responding to their local mechanical environment. Now, we know that the structure of each of these layers is very different, and therefore we would suppose, I think, that the mechanical properties, therefore, are very different. And cells are always continuously sensing their environment. They're always tugging on the matrix around them. And so they can tell if they're in a stiffer or softer environment, to put it simply. And so we think, and we have some evidence to suggest, that perhaps the cells respond differently to a fibrosa mechanical environment or matrix than they do a ventricularis. And I'll talk about that as well. So I'll start by talking about the hemodynamic story. And so, we really don't have a good understanding of what the hemodynamic environment is around the valve. And this is, I think, where the mechanics comes in and the mathematics, in that this is really a complex fluid structure interaction problem in which you have a thin leaflet, here idealized geometry, but the geometry is much more complex than this, moving in this pulsatile flow environment, which is also a complex flow profile. So qualitatively, we know that on the ventricular side, as the blood leaves the heart, this side of the valve sees high shear stresses, and the cells there see high shear stresses and very, pretty much unidirectional flow. On the back side of the valve, the flow is much more disturbed. So the shear stresses are lower in magnitude, the direction is much not consistent, and there's a lot of oscillation. So qualitatively, we describe this as a disturbed flow profile and an undisturbed flow. And we know that the cells on opposite sides will experience different shear stresses. That's sort of the extent of our knowledge. So clearly there's a lot of work that could be done in characterizing this, and I'll get back to that later. We're not doing that work, but I see this as a real opportunity for people who understand fluid structure interactions and computational modeling or other approaches to really define this environment better than what we have so far. But qualitatively, we know there's a difference on the two sides. And so we hypothesized that maybe the fluid flow on the left ventricular side, the ventricular side here, would cause these cells to behave differently than the cells on the aortic side. So these cells experience this undisturbed flow, these cells experience disturbed flow, and maybe that would alter their biological function or phenotype. And perhaps that might explain why, in part, this side of the valve is prone to disease. So we did this by profiling gene expression using microarrays of endothelial cells from the two sides of the valve. And this is in normal pig valves. So the pigs don't show any signs of disease, but even in that normal case, we see that there are hundreds of genes differentially expressed on the two sides of the valve. And so this suggests that possibly due to the hemodynamic environment, we haven't confirmed that that's what's causing these differences, but for some reason, these two populations are very, significantly different, phenotypically different. And what was interesting from a valve calcification story was that genes related to skeletal development and bone formation were highly overexpressed within our data set. And so when we looked at those specifically, we saw a pattern that suggested that the aortic side of the valve, the disease-prone side, that these endothelium were permissive to calcification. And this was reflected in two ways. One, the endothelial cells on the disease-prone side, the aortic side, they expressed proteins or genes for proteins that were associated with bone formation, things like bone morphogenetic protein 4 or ECM extracellular matrix proteins associated with bone and cartilage. So it suggested that the aortic side was producing factors that would promote calcification. But really interesting, I thought, was that there was lower expression or absence of expression of known inhibitors of calcification and fibrosis. So all of these proteins are known in the vascular system to prevent calcification or fibrosis. And our microarrays suggested that they were not expressed on the disease-prone side. And this is one example, osteoprotegerin. You can see it expressed high in the red color here on the ventricular, disease-protected side, but absent from the disease-prone side. And so this suggested that perhaps this valve is inherently susceptible or vulnerable to some systemic insult that might drive disease because it's lacking the protection on this side just under normal conditions. And so we went on to look at some of these factors, and one that really stood out was this CMP, C-type natriuretic peptide. And, we found that Cindy Yip, a PhD student from my lab, found that when she added this peptide, this small protein, to cultures of valve interstitial cells. Under normal conditions, they will form these calcified aggregates. And this is a model of valve calcification. But if she added this CMP, this small protein, it would completely block that process. So this was consistent with CMP perhaps being protective on one side, but because it's absent here, maybe not being able to protect. So CMP is interesting because it's expressed both in the cardiovascular system, the valve, as well, including the valve, as well as the skeletal system where you make bone. And so it seems to play dual roles. It plays a role in vascular smooth muscle biology. It plays a role in fibrosis. It plays a role in bone formation. So it's kind of this interesting molecule, particularly from a calcification perspective, cardiovascular calcification perspective. And it signals through a specific pathway and its receptor. It's known to be regulated by shear stress. So this was consistent with the pattern we saw where it was higher expressed on the high shear side and lower expressed on the low shear side. So that was good confirmation. And it's relevant to human valve disease. It's been shown to be reduced expression in diseased human valves. And so we found the same thing in the pig, that in normal pig valves, CMP is expressed, shown in red here, whereas markers of bone and myofibroblasts or fibrosis, those are absent in the normal valve. But if you induce disease in the pig, early stages of the disease, they show absence of CMP, so loss of this protective factor, and then the appearance of positive cells that are expressing a bone marker and cells that express a fibrosis marker. So as disease is initiating, this seems to be associated, at least correlated, with a loss of the CMP. So it's perhaps, it's possible that CMP is acting as a homeostatic factor. It's maintaining valve health by being present and preventing these pathologic differentiation, and in its absence, that kind of opens the floodgates for it to occur. So we're testing this functionally now in a mouse model where the mouse doesn't make CMP or has defective CMP signaling, and in that case, we'd expect their valves to become diseased more rapidly or under milder conditions. We also, you know, so this suggests this correlation. We've shown in culture that CMP actually blocks both bone formation and fibrosis. So again, if we take our valve interstitial cells, subject them to calcifying conditions, CMP blocks that from occurring. So these are all markers of bone. All the genes are less expressed in the presence of CMP. There's no expression of this enzyme, alkaline phosphatase, that's associated with bone formation, and there's no production of a protein, osteocalcin, that's associated with bone formation. So it appears that CMP can block osteogenic or bone formation, and it also blocks myofibroblast differentiation. So these are valve interstitial cells that have alpha smooth muscle actin in their cytoskeleton, in their stress fibers, and this is a marker for myofibroblasts. And if we add CMP, we completely block that. We reduce expression of this protein that's associated with myofibroblasts. And we think this is occurring through a specific pathway involving transforming growth factor beta and SMAD signaling. I won't go into the details, but basically we think CMP is blocking the downstream signaling that then drives the production of this protein. And we're exploring that further. So I think this is one interesting example, and I think there's probably likely others of proteins that maybe are expressed locally within the valve and expressed predominantly on the disease protected side and therefore are providing this local protection, whereas they're absent or expressed at lower levels on the disease prone side and therefore make this side permissive or vulnerable to disease progression. And again, perhaps this is hemodynamically regulated. That's the big question. In fact, Sue's nephew is working on that problem in my lab right now. But really what is missing from all this is we don't have a good understanding of the hemodynamics. We have, you know, some people, Ajit Yoganathan at Georgia Tech is coming up with experimental approaches to estimate shear stresses on the leaflets. And there's others that are coming up with computational approaches to estimate shear stresses on the leaflets. But really what we're interested in is what's happening at the cellular level, right, at these very micro scale. And to characterize the local hemodynamic environment of that scale is, I think, very challenging. I know it's very challenging. It's again a complex fluid structure interaction. The geometry is complex. And then the material properties, and this is kind of leading into the next section, the properties of the leaflet at that scale are not well defined. And obviously the motion of this leaflet is going to be dictated in part by its mechanical properties and material properties, and we really don't have a good handle on that as well. So I think this is an opportunity for those involved in computational approaches. I think it requires that type of approach, but to better understand this hemodynamic environment, and therefore now and then allow us to start making linkages between the hemodynamics and the biology that we're seeing, and whether this is, you know, whether there is a correlation, and in fact whether this is causative. Does the hemodynamics drive these differences, or is there something inherently different about the cells on the two sides of the valve for some other reason? So that was that part of the story. The other part is then related more to the elasticity or the mechanical properties of the tissue itself, and what might be different about the fibrosa than the other layers, and how these cells then may respond or be responsive to differences in matrix elasticity or stiffness. And so we know that the extracellular matrix and its interaction with cells is very important for regulating cell function more broadly, and certainly in the terms of the valve, there's lots of evidence of that. And so the matrix, this extracellular matrix the cells are embedded in, can play many different roles. It can sequester growth factors and present them very locally to cells in concentrations that they wouldn't see otherwise. So that's one mechanism. The cells can actually respond differently to different matrix proteins through adhesion receptors. So that's another mechanism by which the matrix can regulate the cells. And then there's certainly mechanical influences. So the matrix has its inherent elasticity or compliance, and the cells, again, sense this compliance by continually probing their environment. And there's a lot of good evidence coming out now that cells are very sensitive to matrix stiffness, and this can really modulate their biology. And I'll give you an example from the valve. And then, of course, the leaflet itself is undergoing these large deformations, and those mechanical forces that are due to external hemodynamic and effects are going to obviously cause the cells to become deformed to some extent. And again, we don't really know how a macro scale deformation translates to a cellular scale deformation. And this is, again, I think a big gap, and one that Matthew's actually going to explore. So again, our focus has been on this elasticity question and trying to define the material properties of the valve at a scale that's relevant for cells. Certainly people can take whole valve tissues and stretch them and get some measure of elastic modulus or some measure like that. But we're really interested in what's happening down at sort of this microns or tens or hundreds of microns scale. And so our approach to do this has been to use a relatively simple technique and very simple models to characterize those material properties. So this is work by Krista Sider, a PhD student in the lab. So we use a technique called micropipette aspiration. And it's very simple. The idea is you take a glass pipette, bring it down to the surface of whatever you want to test, in this case the tissue, apply a vacuum, known pressure, and then measure the deformation of the tissue into the pipette. And so obviously a soft tissue will get sucked in further than will a stiff tissue for the same pressure. And we set this up using, syringes to drive the pressure. We measure the pressure, synchronize the video with the pressure so we can get all this data, and use a micro manipulator to move the pipette very specifically onto the valve. So the idea here is we can take an intact valve leaflet, we can lay it out, bring the pipette in, test very locally, and then essentially map the material properties of the valve tissue at different locations. And what we've shown is through computational modeling that finite element analysis that the valve is this tri-leaflet structure. And so our interest was defining the material properties just of the fibrosa or just the ventricularis and not getting a homogenized measure that was kind of homogenized for all three layers. And so we've shown computationally and then validated experimentally that if you have a bilayer structure like this with different moduli in the top and bottom layers, that as you vary the pipette diameter, shown here is the inner diameter of the pipette as a ratio to the top layer thickness, as you vary that, the apparent modulus that you measure will depend on the pipette diameter relative to the thickness of this layer. And basically, the bigger the pipette, the deeper you feel into this composite tissue, and the further you deviate from the actual modulus. So if you're top modulus is stiffer than, if your top layer is stiffer than your bottom layer, and then you use a big pipette, you're going to feel the bottom layer and you're going to underestimate the actual stiffness of the tissue, of the top layer. But if you use pipettes that are about the same diameter as this layer is thick, then you can get a very, you know, a reasonably or very accurate measure of the actual modulus of just the top layer. So we've used this approach to, by sizing the pipette appropriately, we can, and making sure that our pipette isn't any wider than this tissue layer is thick, we can confine our measurement to the fibrosar ventricularis. So that's been our approach. And we get measurements that are very reasonable. So this is a fibrosa in the triangles and a ventricularis in the squares. This is the pressure we applied versus the aspiration length normalized to the pipette radius. And so a steeper curve represents a stiffer tissue, right? For the same applied pressure, we get less deformation of this curve than we do of this curve. And so the fibrosa layer is stiffer than the ventricularis layer in this example. And if you do this over dozens of tests, you find that they're statistically stiffer than the ventricularis. And in particular, there's regions of the fibrosa that are always stiffer than those in the ventricularis, and regions of the ventricularis that are always stiffer, always softer than those in the fibrosa. And so this is a consistent pattern now we've seen over dozens and dozens and dozens of valves. So this approach, this is, I think, maybe my one equation in the whole talk. I apologize for that. But, you know, we've used a very simple constitutive model to measure this, to characterize this. It's nonlinear, but it's an isotropic model. And we know for sure the valve is not isotropic. It exhibits, you know, sizable anisotropy. And, you know, this is kind of the extent of our model at the moment. And then we describe an effective modulus as the product of these two constants. So I see this as a limitation, and this is something I'll talk about it later, but this is really where Matthew, the CMM fellow, is going to come in, is trying to improve our ability to characterize focal or local mechanical properties of valve tissue and intact valves. It's a real challenge that no one's really handled or well at this point. Everyone's doing macro scale measurements, but if we're interested in how cells see their matrix, we have to scale things down. And so this is our current challenge. From this, we got that the fibrosa is stiffer than the ventricularis, and there's certainly regions that are much stiffer. So the question is, so what? Does this influence the biology? And again, that's our focus, how the mechanics influences the biology. So what we've done is we've taken valve interstitial cells, and we've grown them on matrices that in which we've varied the stiffness, or the apparent modulus, I would say. So in this case, what we've done is these are collagen gels, and we've just changed the thickness of the gel. So we have a very thick gel, and the cells sitting on this feel this thick gel is sort of a soft, relatively soft matrix. And then we have a thin gel constrained to the glass plate below here. And because of the thinness of this gel, the cells, when they contract and pull on that gel, they're actually feeling deep enough to feel the stiffness of the underlying glass layer. So to the cells, this appears to be a stiff matrix, and this appears to be a soft matrix. So we haven't varied the composition, we haven't varied the chemistry, the nanostructures, the microstructure is relatively the same. We've just varied the thickness, and in doing so, varied the apparent modulus. And you know, when we do compressive tests, this is all kind of a little hand-wavy in terms of how we characterize these, but if we do compressive testing, we get measures around 25 kilopascals, which we correlate to be similar to the stiffest parts of the fibrosa, and then this is around 110 kilopascals, which is comparable, we think, to diseased sclerotic tissue, although we haven't actually measured that. That's just based on literature values. So the question was this, how do the cells respond biologically to these two different stiffnesses? And the response is significantly different. So when we subject the cells, so when we grow them in kind of standard growth media, they don't really don't do anything. They just sort of grow and they don't seem to be too influenced by the stiffness. But if we now change the media to one that would induce bone formation, so now the chemical cues the cells are seeing would induce bone formation. We find that on the softer gels, we get many more of these bone nodules forming. You can see that here, quantified here. There's much more calcium, so much more calcification on these softer gels. And the nodules appear very different. In this case, they appear to be these colonies forming. In this case, on the stiffer substrate, they appear to actually be balled up, contracted masses of cells and maybe tissue. So simply by varying the tissue, the substrate stiffness, we can, you know, completely change how the cells respond in this calcifying or osteogenic media. And when we look at markers of the types of cells we're getting, it suggests that these softer matrices favor bone formation. So on the softer matrices, we get expression of alkaline phosphatase at higher levels, we get expression of this osteocalcin, we get higher expression of this transcription factor associated with bone and of these genes associated with bone. So the soft matrices favor osteogenesis or bone formation. On the stiffer matrices, we get these myofibroblasts. So they form these cells that have stress fibers that are smooth muscle actin positive. Whereas on the softer matrices, we see SMA being expressed, but it's not incorporated into stress fibers. And so this is the marker of a myofibroblast. This is what's thought to be maybe a proto-myofibroblast, but certainly this is a full-blown myofibroblast. So under the same chemical environment, by simply changing the substrate stiffness, we can direct these cells to become bone versus myofibroblast. So clearly the cells are sensitive to their environment and sensitive to the stiffness of their substrate. And you know, so maybe there is something to this idea that the inherent stiffness of the tissue may be important. And we've gone on then to test a wider range of stiffnesses, including softer gels that are more similar to what you'd see in the valve. And we find this sweet spot, this kind of peak at which osteogenic or bone formation is maximal. And then if we go to higher stiffnesses, we lose bone and we gain myofibroblasts. And if we go to softer gels, we lose both bone and myofibroblasts. And we don't really know what these cells are. We call them quiescent, but they may be something else, and I'll get back to that later. And then if we overlay our measurements of the actual elastic properties of the valve matrix, we see that this sweet spot only occurs in certain regions of the fibrosa, those particularly stiff regions. And in the majority of the ventricularis or the majority of the fibrosa, there really isn't, these mechanical environments, the cells really are not responsive and not really doing much in response to these calcifying factors. So this has led us to suggest that perhaps the inherent stiffness of the substrate, of the tissue, may set up a situation that's permissive to osteogenic differentiation in some cases, preventive in other cases, and as the valve stiffens and becomes fibrotic, maybe then it promotes even more myofibroblast differentiation. So that's all very hypothetical at this point. It's all based on culture conditions, it's all based on growing cells on biomaterials, and then these measurements that are, again, admittedly relatively rough, but, you know, there might be something to that. Our approach to test that it's hard to test this the cause-effect relationship here, because it's hard to go in and alter the properties of a valve, for example, and see what the consequence is biologically. But we're looking for correlations in actual, like, living valves, and seeing whether these correlations between substrate mechanics and biology, whether these then translate into the in vivo circumstance. Because that's really, I think, what we need to do in order to show that this is just not an artifact of cell culture. And so our approach to do this is we grow pigs, full-size pigs. We do this out at Guelph, and we feed them either a normal diet or we give them a high-fat diet, a high-cholesterol, high-fat diet, and we do it for 2 or 5 months. So we're trying to look at the very early changes that occur in valve disease. And can we pick up, you know, very early on, can we pick up the appearance of bone cells, osteoblasts, or myofibroblasts? And if we then measure the mechanical properties of the valve and then look at the cells in those same regions, can we show correlations, spatial correlations, in the real valve tissue? That was our goal. And to do this, again, we implemented this model. Now, it turns out that doesn't work at all. And the reason it doesn't work is our model turns out not to be what we expected. So at 2 or even at 5 months, what we see in the valve is we see the appearance of these lesions in the fibrosa, so that's consistent with human disease, and they're rich in the proteoglycan, an extracellular matrix molecule that is not typically found in the fibrosa. Remember, this is the molecules that are found in the spongiosa. But in this early disease, we get these lesions forming up here in the fibrosa that are rich in proteoglycan, shown here in blue. Interestingly, these changes occur before we get any lipid or macrophages, inflammatory cells. And the current thinking is that these are required, actually. The first steps of valve disease are lipid infiltration and inflammation, just like other vascular diseases. But our data suggest in this model, or indicate in this model, that that's not the case. The first changes, we don't see any extensive lipid infiltration, we don't see any macrophages or inflammatory cells, And so the initial changes appear to be these matrix changes. So that's interesting just from a valve disease perspective. But, you know, not great for us was we don't actually see any myofibroblasts, and we don't see any osteoblasts, even at 2 or 5 months. And again, our whole goal here was to try and find osteoblasts and myofibroblasts and correlate those to the local mechanical environment in vivo. So it's not a good model for looking at this because we don't have the cells that we're after. The other issue we've run up against is if we look at the local modulus measured by micropipette aspiration and attempt to correlate that to the type of tissue that's there, we see really no clear or strong correlations between our mechanical property measurements and the composition of the tissue, how much is collagen and how much is proteoglycan. And, you know, maybe naively we expected that to be the case. We thought if there was more collagen, it would be stiffer. If there's more proteoglycan, it'd be softer. We see that to a certain extent. I'll show you that in a minute. But generally, when we look at a wide range of conditions, we're not seeing this correlation. So I don't know whether this is because our measurement method is very simple. I think that's probably part of it. We're not really capturing the full mechanics. And our, you know, our ability or our method of characterizing the composition is just how much, you know, what fraction of the area is collagen, what fraction is proteoglycan. There's obviously other factors involved, cross-linking of the matrices, other factors that influence tissue structure and function that we're missing with our characterization. So I'm not convinced that there isn't a correlation. I think maybe just our methods are not adequate to pick up these correlations. And again, this is where Matthew's going to come in from an analytical perspective and developing material models. What are the types of measurements we would need to make to really better characterize the properties of this tissue at this small scale? And so I think that'll be a real advance for us in terms of understanding this and for the field in terms of understanding valve micromechanics. The one kind of exception to this, and it's a little bit anecdotal, but when we look at these proteoglycan-rich lesions, and in some cases, it's kind of, you know, we don't know ahead of time what the tissue looks like within the matrix. We just sort of test and then go back afterwards and see what we tested. So in the cases where we've happened just to measure the properties of a proteoglycan lesion and only probe deep enough to measure just the proteoglycans, they tend to be softer than the rest of the tissue. So this is expected. We expected the proteoglycans to be softer. And so they tend to be much more on the low end of what we've seen, at least for the limited samples we have. And interestingly, the cells that seem to associate down here in these bottom of these proteoglycan lesions express a molecule called SOX9. SOX9 is a marker, is a transcription factor for chondrocytes, cartilage cells. And so this is an interesting finding from a couple perspectives. One, chondrocytes and cartilage is thought to be involved in valve calcification. And so there's evidence in advanced human disease that there are cartilage in those valves and there's cartilage or chondrogenic programs going on. So this may be the initial stages of that disease process. The other thing is that if you take mesenchymal stem cells, which we think the valve is a good model of, if you take those cells and put them on very soft matrices and treat them with transforming growth factor beta, for example, a chemical, those cells will become cartilage cells. So just like the valve cells are sensitive to their substrate stiffness, so too are mesenchymal stem cells. And the soft matrices are ones that promote chondrogenesis or cartilage formation. So, you know, one possibility is that these cells are expressing or becoming cartilage-like cells because their local mechanical environment is this soft environment. And then on top of that, they're experiencing some chemical cues that drive that process. And so this might be kind of on the low end down here, at the softer substrates where we really haven't characterized the cells yet. Perhaps these cells really aren't quiescent, but under the appropriate chemical conditions, given these soft substrates, maybe this is actually driving chondrogenesis or cartilage formation. And maybe that's what we're seeing here. So again, very speculative. We just submitted a grant to study kind of what's going on with these lesions in terms of the proteoglycans and how this microenvironment may drive the differentiation of these cells to cartilage cells as a very early event in valve disease that's really been underappreciated. So you know, so again, we're very interested in how the matrix can regulate the cells, and both in terms of its elasticity, and then also we're doing some work in how then the dynamic stretch in the tissue can influence the cells. The big gap there is we can take cells and we can stretch individual cells and see what happens. But we don't know if the amount we're stretching them is realistic, because we don't know how much a valve cell in an actual valve, what are the forces experienced by that individual cell sitting in a big, big matrix. So that macro to micro linkage is not well described, and again, it's another area of really open for investigation. So part of the challenges we face are in characterizing these interactions between the cell and the matrix. And particularly the mechanical interactions are shown here. We go from a normal leaflet that looks like this to something that looks like this, right? And so this is, you can see there's lots of these, purple here is bone, so there's all these bone nodules in here. There's a complete disruption of the nice structure. This, you know, the ECM composition changes, the organization changes. This obviously changes how the leaflet behaves on a macro scale, and so this will influence the stresses and strains and the forces experienced by the cells embedded in here. The interaction between the cells and their matrix change substantially, because the cells are now seeing different matrices. And you know what's possible as well, and I'll get to this, is that maybe the cells themselves actually change their mechanical properties as this disease progresses. And you can imagine a cell sitting in a matrix, the amount that that cell deforms, and if that's driving its biology, that will be influenced not only by its environment, but also by its inherent mechanical properties. And so we've done some work on that using, again, micropipette aspiration. This is Christine Weiss's work. And so taking valve cells, we can, again, suck them with this micropipette. And now this is down to the scale of, you know, 5 microns. And again, by measuring deformation, we can back out measures or estimates of the mechanical properties or viscoelastic properties, actually, of the cell. And so the typical way to characterize this is using a linear half-space model, so a simple analytical model that assumes linear elasticity, that assumes the cell is in half-space, so infinite in this direction, doesn't account for the size of the cell. But you can, using this model, and it's a very commonly used model, you can get the elastic modulus as a function of the applied pressure, and it's dependent, here you can see, on the pipette radius and an empirical constant that characterizes the properties of the pipette. And then, and here's the aspiration length. So using this, this is kind of the model people typically use. Clearly, it's a simplification. The cell isn't a half space. It's a round object in this case. The cell is not, behaves nonlinear, behaves viscoelastically. There's contact here that's not accounted for in this model. And so we've used finite element models in order to try and understand how poor is this model for interpretation of our specific data. And so we come up with, you know, simple models of the cell, can vary the material properties of the constitutive model that we use to express how the cell behaves. And so what's shown here is we've plotted here, in this case we're particularly interested in how does the size of the cell matter, because experimentally you get the cells you get, and you have pipettes, and it's hard to control with any accuracy or to a high degree of accuracy the size of the pipette. So you're kind of stuck with some combination of pipette diameter and cell size. And that's shown here. That's the ratio shown here. So this is the pipette radius to the cell radius. And so smaller values mean small pipettes compared to the cell. And then what we've plotted here is the normalized stiffness. This is the stiffness, or the in this case, the shear moduli measured by the finite element method relative to the half-space model. And so you can see that the instantaneous shear modulus and the equilibrium shear modulus are very sensitive to this pipette to cell ratio. And it's only when you get down to very small pipettes to cell sizes that you get something that approximates the analytical model. And so we've gone away from the analytical model. We now use a finite element model or some derivative of that because typically experimentally we're working up in this range. And so, you know, we'd be looking at 80% errors if we didn't account for the cell size. So we're using this as our method to analyze, and kind of in an inverse approach, analyze our experimental data. So when we do that, and we take our valve cells and subject them to conditions that cause them to differentiate, both starting at a fibroblast and then to a bone-forming cell and then to a myofibroblast, we see that their mechanical properties do change as their phenotype or their function changes. So the cells within the valve And we, you know, this is induced in culture, so we don't know for sure this occurs in vivo. But the cells in the valve appear as they change their function and change their phenotype. They're also changing their mechanical properties, and so this should then influence how the stress or strain transfer between the matrix and the cell. And so this is another complication in this whole story of cell matrix interactions, and one we've attempted to approach experimentally. But certainly there's opportunity to look at that computationally or analytically. To further complicate matters, if you take these cells and then treat them with that C-type matrix peptide, that chemical I talked about earlier, that peptide, you can actually knock them all back down to baseline, essentially. So it's not only dependent on their phenotype, it really depends on all the microenvironmental cues. So the stiffness of the cell is going to be very dynamic. It's going to be responding to its matrix. It's going to be responding to its environmental chemical cues. And so this is really, I think, a challenge because it's a bit of a moving target. And you don't know under any specific circumstance what will the nature of that cell specifically be. But for sure, the cell properties are very dynamic and can differ or change with disease. And so this is, I guess, another complexity in this whole problem. So I'll just wrap up there. So I think it's now well accepted that this is a common disease that we're studying. It's a debilitating disease. It's actively regulated, but there's currently no cure. So there's importance to look at it and to understand the lack of a cure, I think, is largely because we don't really understand the cellular and molecular bases. So our approach to this has been to really focus in on this side dependency and use that as a clue to what may be some of the factors involved. And the mechanical environment is one factor that we've particularly focused in on because it's clearly distinct in the disease-prone region. And this includes both the hemodynamics, which might be regulating the production of these soluble signals, as well as the local tissue properties that may be regulating how these cells respond to that tissue property, as well as respond to other stimuli. And this idea, this our goal of linking mechanics and biology, I think we do an okay job on the biology. We do kind of a basic job on the mechanics, but really to link these well, it really does require these improved characterizations at the scale we're working at, which is down out of the cellular scale. And so I see this as a big challenge both in our work, but also more generally in mechanobiology and cellular cell mechanics and even cell biology, is what is a cell feeling, a single cell in a tissue, what does it feel? Because all the biology, or most of the biology experiments are done in culture, where we apply certain forces to the cell, and we don't really know if we're mimicking what the cell would feel in vivo. So the translation of all these experiments to real medicine is still, up for debate. So that's all I have. So I just want to acknowledge the people in the lab and our collaborators and our funding, and I'd be happy to take questions if there are any.